What makes a law firm? It's about passion, knowledge, understanding, and service. That's what defines Fluxmans. In this podcast series, we take you behind the desks of some of South Africa's smartest legal minds. I had the great pleasure of sitting down to talk to a man of enormous experience, the CEO of Fluxmans. His name is Philip Vallett, and he's an attorney of some repute who presides over this incredible collection of great legal minds that forms the center of Fluxmans Attorneys. Phil, how much has changed over the years? How much have you seen change happening?
There are huge changes, and it's challenging.
Right.
It's challenging for us because there's been a cultural shift even in our firm. We've always had a history that we were very fixated on culture. And the culture was a friendly culture. You'll feel it when you come in the firm. And respect. I didn't encourage any arguments. For example, in our directors' meetings, there are 35 of us sitting around the table.
Wow.
Nothing contentious is ever discussed in a directors' meeting itself. Because once something is said, can't be unsaid.
So, mm-hmm.
And we focus very much on culture. Culture is now under threat. And it's under threat because things are so expensive. And money has entered into the arena.
Right.
So we used to say that if you come to Fluxmans, you're not coming for the money, you're coming for the lifestyle. And it's true. But that the amount of money we did pay was enough. But today, it's not enough sometimes, especially for guys who have to educate their kids.
Well, I'm curious about how the whole legal fraternity in South Africa has changed its view on the practice, on firms, on what it means to be a partner, what it means to be an associate these days, what it means to be a candidate attorney in one of the big firms, and particularly how you've navigated that during your time here at Fluxmans.
Well, the most startling fact is that lawyers are far less collegial than we used to be.
That's a sad thing.
That's a very sad thing. Yeah, and that to me is the saddest thing about our profession, is that the respect that we used to have for each other is lacking. And I don't know what has caused that. I think it may be the size of the firms, and it may be the shifting nature of business and the size you have to be. When I started, there were only small firms in South Africa. We didn't know about big firms. I think the biggest firm might have been 20 partners. That would have been Weber Wenzel or Denise Rates.
Sure.
And Edward Nathan, I can remember, was the same size as we were. I was at Trafalgar Wiener.
Yeah.
So there weren't any really, really large corporate firms, and all the lawyers knew each other. And that gradually started to shift. And it started to shift into a much more corporate space.
Did it become adversarial?
Adversarial, much more than that. And I think it's the training that they give their lawyers, because they lawyers have. I don't know. We've lost the respect we had for each other.
Do you think it might also have to do with like timesheets and billable hours?
Everything to do with
all of that. Those are strictures on people being familiar and spending an extra 10 minutes with someone and talking in terms of, you know, are you interested in this? Do you know about that? How's your wife? You know, what's happening?
Well, laws become a business more than a practice. We still don't have timesheets at Fluxmans. And
that must be quite a rare thing.
I'm told it's a rare thing, but we've never had a timesheet. If you're a partner here, we trust you that you'll do the time. And we can see your numbers at the end of the day, but I don't want to know where you spend your time. As long as at the end of the month you have fairly decent numbers, you can live the life you want to live.
And is that also dependent on clients? Because if you have a certain kind of client, they're going to want certain things.
No, they will.
And
they
other
will.
Clients yes. will trust
no,
you.
No, they will, but they won't ask you for a timesheet.
Mm.
When we bill, when you're billing a client, then you're keeping a timesheet. But you're keeping the timesheet for yourself for the purpose of billing, and that you'll send the timesheet down to the accounting department, and they will work out how much time you've got and what your fee is compared to your rate. But it's not something that I would look at.
But
you wouldn't have to report to me on your time.
No, sure. But I'm curious also because you have clients that have long-standing relationships with this firm.
Yes, I do.
And who regard that as the primary reason that they like doing business with you.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from the fact that you have hugely competent lawyers and you guys deliver great work, it's also about those relationships, right?
Yes. I would put Fluxmans as more of a middle cap company, because we depend on relationships that we have within our client. We're not a big firm. We're what, 60 lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the bigger firms are over 200 lawyers. We can do the same work. We'll do it with less people, but our rates are the same.
Right.
And I think our relationships with the clients are different. But it takes a very confident CEO to use Fluxmans for his major work. Because CEOs today are nervous about their own position. And so if you're looking to cover your bum, you're going to go to a bigger firm. And then it's not your fault, it's their fault.
Well, I had an incident, well, a legal situation not so long ago, and I remember the people who I was up against brought in 14 lawyers and, you know, they looked like they meant business and they ended up losing anyway, which I was very pleased with because I had one lawyer and one advocate. And I thought at the time the reason that they're doing this is so that they can be seen to be more than they are. It's not really about the quality of the work. One person can argue as effectively as...
I think in litigation, the question is how good is your case?
Mm.
Cases win cases.
Yeah.
You can lose a case because you haven't prepared. But at the end of the day, if you've prepared your case and you have the law on your side, you should win it. It doesn't matter how many lawyers are on the other side. It depends on your case. And I think one of the biggest issues in winning a good case is preparation. So if you do the preparation, you'll know whether you've got a good case or not.
You have personally over the years done a lot of commercial law, business rescue, that kind of thing.
Not really business rescue. That's dealt with by Strahm and others here. I've done a lot of commercial work.
Right. What's the thing there that drew you in the first place? Because you could have specialized in anything, I'm sure.
I think it was when Rafaeli Wiener, where I was at, when we merged with Fluxmans, I worked with a guy called Joe Rabinowitz and Gerald Rubenstein. They were doyens of the profession, and they really knew what they were doing, and I learned from them. So they started putting me on the boards of companies for whom we acted, and that was started about 25 years ago. So for the last 25 years... I've spent much of my time really just on that, at that sort of level, dealing on the boards of companies. There are not many lawyers anymore who I have found are on the boards of companies. Very few.
But it must give you a very unique insight into how, first of all, the businesses work, and secondly, it must be of huge benefit for them to have someone with legal experience.
Well,
and legal,
I suppose
legal understanding.
Yes, because the business world is not the legal world.
Yeah.
And corporate work is not the work that we think it is, or the corporate thinking. I've been a CEO twice. The first time was for a company called Profern Furnishes. You won't remember it. It was a long time ago.
Furniture, I'm assuming?
Okay, yes, it was furniture. Although those times we used to think furniture companies were, they started saying that furniture companies were really banks. And that furniture was just a product, and that banking was really the big story.
Because they do lay-bys and that kind of
and,
thing.
Right? Well, it was, yes. It was, so you saw it as a little bank, and now that was Profern's thinking. It wasn't. Furniture store is still a furniture store. People right. go to furniture stores to buy furniture. Okay, so I don't think the bank idea worked. But we can see today it hasn't worked. And Profern was in trouble, so Gerald, who was their lawyer, asked me if I would go in because one of the casualties was a guy called Walker. He was a really, really competent guy, but he had to take the blame.
Uh-huh.
So, and I did that job for about 4 or 5 months, and then more latterly at Supergroup, when Supergroup ran into trouble in 2008. there was a huge issues around Supergroup at the time, and Larry and the financial director left, and there were really very few executives, so I was asked if I would act as an interim CEO. That gave me a lot of insight. I did it for about 4 months, and then I found Peter Mountford, who was working for one of the divisions, and then Peter could be appointed CEO, and I became chairman.
And you've remained chairman?
I'm still chairman.
And Supergroup is...
Supergroup's flying. That's because of Peter.
Great story.
He's a fantastic CEO. Good implementation. I thought of some of the things we should do, but he implemented it. It's easy to think up ideas, not so easy to implement.
It must be gratifying to have been part of a success story and a turnaround story like that, because there are many people who look at the economy now, and we're seeing businesses fall down left, right, and center. I'm sure you guys see them coming in here too and asking you for your expertise and asking you to help them and figure out what to do next. But sometimes when things are bad, there's an opportunity there to turn things around, and there's an opportunity there to take advantage of the fact that everyone else is down as well and to plant the seeds for a future harvest. I mean, it's tough.
The trouble is if people are doing badly and you're measuring yourself against that, that's sort of a danger. Because for me, it's a question of confidence. From when we had in the country in the last 8 years, the confidence has been eroded. When the confidence comes back, the economy will come back.
Yeah, well, because, we can only hope.
Yeah.
Tell me about what the law was like when you started. The sorts of traditions, the way people used to practice, and you used the word practice earlier instead of saying it's a business. What kinds of things drew you to it in the first place and made you happy to be a lawyer in the very beginning? And even if those things are still there, they might have changed.
I think the big difference is that we became lawyers to practice law, and we enjoyed that. It was a collegial atmosphere. It was a small. There weren't that many lawyers around as there are today. So obviously, and we knew each other. We knew each other's weaknesses. We knew strengths, and by and large, we got on well. We had characters. There were a lot of characters there, and as article clerks, when we weren't there. We had a band, and we used to go down to court to do the Section 65, which is a debtors' court.
Yeah.
I can tell you a funny story about that.
Sure.
We used to, in Section 65, you had to appear before a magistrate. The debtor was never there. And you went through the whole procedure, served on such and such a date, no appearance to defend, and you used to ask for a warrant of arrest. And the magistrate used to give you the warrant of arrest, and that was... And you used to deal with a whole lot of these in debtors' court.
And then, of course, the sheriff's meant to go and attach.
Yeah, but nobody... Well, this was what they called it. You did it under Section 65. It was supposed to be inquiry into the debtors' financial affairs.
Okay.
But the debtors never used to arrive. Very surprising if they arrived. And we used to have probably 10 or 20 each a day. And so I had a wager with a colleague of mine, who was also an article clerk, that I could do it quicker than he could. That I could say less than he could and I would get the order quicker. And we had the bet. But I knew the magistrate, so I went to see the magistrate and I told him about the bet. And I said to him, look, I've got this bet going with Leon. He knew who my colleague is. We all knew each other. And I said, can I run through the matters with you now? And then when I get up, you'll have really seen the matters. He thought it was really good. So I went through my matters. I had 10. So the first one that he called up, I stood on my feet and he looked at me and he said, order granted. I didn't say a word.
That was probably, if it was ever reported, the shortest
appearance. It wasn't an important. I mean, it was our little court. It wasn't really significance. Oh, yes, no, but I wasn't finished with him. Because what the magistrate did is he decided that he was going to extend this. So when Leon stood up, he took him through everything. When Leon says that summons was served in such and such a date, he said, where was it served, Mr. Sarovitz? Who was it served by? And he asked him a number of questions, which he never did to anyone else. And then Leon sat down and he called my matter and I stood up and he said, warrant granted. And so this went on for the 10. Anyway, The bet was that Leon had to pay for breakfast because we always went to breakfast. There was a cafe there called the Adura Cafe. And we all went for breakfast. And he had to pay for the breakfast. And as he was about to pay, I told him. So, and it was that type of thing. My first job as an article clerk was to park my boss's car. And I used to sit in the office, and this happened for a year. I used to sit in a little office. He used to come by in the morning. He used to throw his keys at me and say, "Phil, will you park my car?" And I said, that was my job.
And like a valet?
Yes. No, well, I parked in the basement. It was in New Street South where all the buses were. So he used to throw it to me. He was parked in front.
Yeah.
I used to take it, drive around the corner, into the basement, come up, give me his keys back. So one day he came to me and he threw me keys and he said, "Phil, I've just bought Michael, who was his brother, a car. And you'll recognize it. It was one of those Citroens that used to go up and down, if you remember, suspension." This was in 1969, 70. Yeah. So I went out. The car was still running because I said, "How am I going to get there?" So he said, "The keys in the car." And then he told me because he hadn't thrown them at me.
Wow.
He didn't tell me it's a Citroen and I can park it. So I got into it. Very nice car. And I drove it, and then I was going to turn to New Street South. But there was a bus that came down. It was a bus terminal. Somehow or other, the bus had hooked on to the front of the car.
Oh, no.
But the bus kept going. And so this car was hitting all the parked cars, the car I was in, and little bits were flying off.
Oh, God.
The conductor was frantically pulling for the bus. You know, used to have
a rope, like a chain.
It was like
An emergency brake.
Yeah, an emergency brake that he used to pull so the driver could see that he needed to stop. But he didn't stop. So by the time I had got to the corner, there was very little left of the car. In fact, there was nothing. There was my seat and me, the steering wheel, because these cars were made of plastic and it just fell apart. So anyway, the superintendent of the bus terminus came along and he was very concerned because I think his driver had been drinking. So he was very clear to make it that they were responsible and there would be no problems that day. And, you know, nobody was hurt.
Yeah.
There were a lot of wrecked cars. And I came to Victor and I said to him, he said, "Where were you so long?" So I said, "No, I had a little incident with the car." So he said, "Take it to Lou Apple." Lou Apple was a client of ours and he was a panel beater. "Just take it to Lou." He didn't get excited, Vic, very calm guy.
But all that was left was
well,
you.
Well, I said, "Vic, no, I don't think you understand, Vic, there's no car left." So he says, "What do you mean there's no car?" I said, "Vic, the car's in pieces." Anyway, came down to have a look and he saw the funny side immediately. Yeah. And he told his brother, "Michael, I had brought you the car, but I haven't got it anymore."
But all was sorted out in the end.
It was like a highlight of my article. Clarkship.
Incredible.
Yeah. But he carried on and asked me to park his car. It didn't have an adverse effect. Yeah.
And being an article clerk in those days, I mean, you were squeezed into a corner, piled under files. You were required to do whatever was necessary, laundry or parking car, as you say, or having to rush to court, to rush to get a stamp here, to go and see a client, to pick something up. It was anything you were required to do, right?
Yes, but that was all right. That was our job.
Yeah, but that's not how it is for article clerks.
Not anymore, no. No, there's things called, I don't know, human rights.
Now, oh, no.
Clerks now have rights. So
outrageous.
If you ask them to do things for you, you know, it's...
Outrageous.
You know, it is outrageous.
Now, who do you get to do those things? You have to do them yourself.
So you have to... Well, I've got a really, really nice PA.
Okay,
she does a lot of stuff for me.
You're lucky.
Yeah.
So tell me, when it comes to the kind of culture in here, because I've met a lot of the people here at Flaxman's, and while they're all excellent lawyers, no doubt, there are varying personalities, and they all have a different lean and a different bent and a different kind of place in the machinery of the firm. How is it, from the point of view of a CEO, how difficult is it to try and herd cats effectively? That's what you probably have to do some of the time when it requires like the culture of the firm.
Well, it's not that difficult because the at the end of the day, the partners who are partners here are partners for a reason. And they partners because they like the way we live. They enjoy the way we live.
Yeah.
And I think it appeals to them. So the debates that we do have tend to be Socratic rather than adversarial. Mm-hmm. We don't try and convince each other. We'll give you our point of view. You'll give me your point of view. And that'll be the end of the argument. There won't be an argument. So we've had a very good run. We have very, very few partners who have left for other firms. I can think of only two.
Really?
Yeah.
That has to be
in all the time that I've been the CEO.
That has to be pretty rare.
Yeah. Partners have left to go into business.
Right.
They've left to go and join clients.
Yeah.
But they haven't left to go and join another firm in numbers.
How hard is it to become a partner?
Well, you've got to first buy into the whole culture of issues at Clarks, because we don't train a lot. We've grown mostly organically.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have the last merger, in inverted commas, small one, was about 12 years ago when mm-hmm. Colin Strahm joined, because they were three, four partners. That was our large merger. And since then, we've just met individual lawyers who we think would prefer this type of practice, and they've come. And they've bought into it. It's becoming more difficult because it's becoming very expensive for younger partners with children.
Mm.
You know, I don't know, when we were Article Clerks, I mean, my first salary was 40 rand a month.
Mm.
And when I qualified, it became 120 rand.
Wow,
can't ever remember worrying about money.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And when and my children were educated, it cost very little. I think my education cost my father 10 shillings. 10 shillings would be equal to 10 to a half a pound.
And I'm sure for him
that's a half a rand, 50 cents.
It was exorbitant.
Well, you know, he never talked much, but he paid for my education. Today, it's a very expensive item.
Yeah.
So there's much, much more pressure on young lawyers today than there was in my day. I think it's much more difficult for them, and they're more. And to stand out as a lawyer today is difficult.
Well, in
my day it wasn't that difficult.
Well, you talk about those characters. I mean, you must have met some of these people who we now only read about, these people who were there at the start of South Africa's law growing outside of...
Well, I worked with two who were very well known. The first one was Joe Rabinowitz. Joe Rabinowitz was a legend.
Yeah?
He was an outstanding lawyer, but he would act for anyone, down and out. Didn't matter. He would go to the magistrate's court and he'd appear in the maintenance court. He'd act for a banker then in the Supreme Court and he'd meet them both the same day. He was an incredible lawyer, very quietly spoken, never lost his temper. So, and I learned from Joe. And then there was Gerald Rubenstein. Gerald was an entrepreneur, great entrepreneur,
mm-hmm.
and I learned a lot from Gerald. Gerald taught me about corporate life. So I was very lucky. I was in the right place at the right time.
And how have you seen the court system change and judges change?
You know, we've always had good judges and bad judges. We always have, ever since I've been practicing. Because judges, there's a political issue to it.
Mm.
And there was always. There was always a political issue to it. And there are good judges and bad judges. So, and I think it's the same. It used to be the same. I think it's changed. I think there's less good judges than there used to be. Okay.
Do you think that people are intimidated by lawyers? Because for ordinary members of the public, it can be a scary thing to... You usually meet lawyers when something horrible is happening in your life. Not necessarily.
Well, not always. Not always. We've
when
got
are the
a bad
things?
Rap. No, there are lots, there are lots of good things. There are lots of good things
like,
that you can see lawyers.
Like a contractual disagreement, a divorce, a murder. I mean, when?
No, like getting, you can get married. You can buy a business. No, I think that I don't know why lawyers are intimidating. I don't find them intimidating, but then I'm a lawyer. They shouldn't be. They shouldn't be intimidating.
You mentioned earlier when you were talking about your clients that a brave CEO would appoint Flaxmans because you need to understand that there's a different dynamic here and that it'll be about the matter. And
it'll be about the matter. And there's a tendency.
It's not showboating.
But it's not only – I mean, it's in everything. People who are controlling something want to make sure that they can't be held responsible.
Certain kind of people. People like you don't seem to shirk responsibility, though. You've been the boss here for a long time, and by that I mean obviously equal among partners. But
18 years.
That's an incredibly long time to have to bear all those responsibilities, and you've obviously seen good and bad things happen. But for you, what would you like to?
Well, I can tell you, I wasn't expected to live as long.
really, well, Phil? Is that because you ride a motorbike?
How I became a CEO is a number of partners had died after becoming CEO, and about three or four. So when I was appointed, I smoked 40 cigarettes a day. I was racing my motorcycle.
Yeah.
But I became CEO, and we thought the trend would continue.
We thought, 4 years.
But it didn't,
Well, I'm very happy.
So it continued.
I'm happy that you broke the trend. But in that time, what do you think the firm has become? Because there must be a part of you that is able, not due to your own achievement here or your own leadership here, but there must be some element of this that gives you great pride in seeing how other people have...
The whole firm gives me pride. For example, at our year-end function, there are 200 people, and I look at them, and these are people who work for us. These are people who depend on us for a living, and there's a sort of a culture together, and I'm proud of that. So, the lawyers are only a part of it. Yeah, probably not the biggest part. The biggest part is our people, the people who work here.
But that's an interesting point that you make, because we get talking about the lawyers and we forget about all the other support staff that make a firm happen.
Absolutely.
I mean, all the PAs here, who outnumber the lawyers, I'm sure.
No. The PAs, sorry, I thought you were talking about associates. Yes, they do.
Yeah.
So if we've got 120 staff and we've got 60 lawyers, so it's 2-1. And our employees are fantastic. Our staff are fantastic. So, we try and incorporate them into the firm because they really are the firm.
There's some elements of your personality that I think are very endearing. You don't like touting. You don't like the idea of boasting. You guys have this lovely building, but it's still... It's not showy like some of the.
Well, we were brought up in that tradition.
Is that what?
Yes, I still find it embarrassing. I still find it distasteful to say I'm a great lawyer, and to say this firm can do great things. I just find it embarrassing because it goes against all my training. We weren't allowed to advertise. I still think we shouldn't be allowed to advertise.
Then I'll say it for you. You're a great lawyer. This is a great firm. You're doing great things.
It's I'm too soft to be a great leader.
I think
I'm a good leader, but I'm not a great leader.
But I don't know.
I don't have the ruthlessness in me.
No. If you're saying you're great, you're being like Donald Trump, brassy and noisy.
But if I look at what I think makes a good leader.
Yeah.
A great leader, I would say he's got to have a sort of a ruthlessness about him. I can't do any firing.
Well, you told me a story about how a very large and reputable law firm in America was taken over by a guy who had to come in and make some tough choices.
Oh, it wasn't a law firm.
Tell me that
story. It was a corporate.
Yeah?
It was a large corporate. And it had gone into a recession, and it was threatened. Its whole existence was threatened, and they brought in what they termed as a top turnaround specialist. So there were about, I would think, 20 executive directors of this company, and they were now waiting for the turnaround specialist to arrive, and of course they were nervous. But he arrived, and he was a nondescript, and he didn't look threatening. He didn't talk threatening. In fact, he talked very little. He spoke in a very quiet voice, and he said, no, he just wants to get to know the place. So he walked around. For a month, he walked around this building, and he found out what everybody did, and he talked to everybody. So when he came across typists, he would talk to the typists, ask them how long they'd been there, who did they work for, showed an interest in everyone. And gradually they lost their fear. And they became used to him, and they said, well, I don't know how successful he'll be. He hasn't opened his mouth. And they felt that they were all intimidating him instead of the other way around. But one day he came into the boardroom and he called them all and he laid out a map, schematic diagram of a building they were moving to, and he told them that we're moving the firm. And can you please come back to me in a few days and just show me where you're going to put everyone? And he gave them the map, and they went to look at it, and they came back to him, and they said, it's impossible. We can't fit everybody in. He said, yes, I know that. Okay. So,
and that was the end of it.
And that was the end, yes. So he cut it, and that's what he did.
Well,
and it was a story that always impressed me. The other story that impressed me was Lee Iacocca from Chrysler, when they called him in. I don't know if you've heard of Lee Iacocca. Well, he was very well known in American corporate circles, and he was called in to save Chrysler, the motor company. And he arrived at this at Chrysler, and he found that some of his executives had not had a vacation for 12 years. And they were really, really all very competitive people, but they were all very tense. They hadn't had holidays. So he said to them that in future, it's compulsory for the executives to have 6 weeks off. And during that time, they're locking the office. Nobody will touch his matters. Because people used to feel threatened if they went away, they'd come back and felt, well, they weren't needed. So, because somebody else had done their work. And I was really impressed. And then he said something that the CEO doesn't have to be the cleverest guy in the room. He said, and he shouldn't, and doesn't have to be the highest paid, because the people who are the most valuable in the company are its salespeople. He was talking about Chrysler. And a good salesman is worth two good CEOs.
Wow.
Yeah, because that's what runs the business. And I was impressed by that. And saying, well, what is a CEO really? He doesn't have to be the smartest guy in the room. He has to be able to get people to do good work, not to fight with each other. That's basically what he has to do.
Well, there are two excellent examples of the kind of leadership It sort of it makes your comment about good and great earlier seem like maybe it's a little it's a deft and humble thing that you're saying there. But I hope that the firm continues to grow. I've certainly spent a couple of good hours here talking to some very, very clever people and some very nice people.
They are nice. I was going to say that the people. I hope that our partners are nice. The one thing I can't stand shouting. And I don't like to hear anybody shout. You can't shout at anybody who can't shout back. And that's basically the rule. It is no purpose it's a really a character defect if you're shouting at people who work for you. You can shout at people who you work for, but you can't shout at people who work for you. And I think that really is what we try and achieve here.
It's happening. It's happening under our very eyes. Yeah. So thank you so much for giving us some of your time. And I hope that we'll continue this conversation and we'll be able to meet everyone else in the building who we haven't already met. And in time, give everyone else an idea of how the place works, what kind of people work here, and what kind of work you do.
Yeah. I think you'd probably get the fairest idea if you speak to perhaps our candidate attorneys.
I'm curious to.
Yes,
is there a means you use to select these candidate attorneys? Yes, I mean, there are a dime a dozen if they're coming out of varsity at the rate
that they are. Yes, there is. There's quite a procedure. I'm not involved in it. We've got a committee that decide these things. So I don't decide it, they do.
But it's complicated.
I think it is, yes. And they do, they by and large, they do a good job because most of the people that are articled here stay with us. And that's how we've grown.
Talent spotting.
Yeah.
Thank you, Phil. You've been listening to Fluxman's Attorneys for the Love of Law. For more information, go to fluxmans.com.